Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Steve Horner from the Rocky Mountain Adaptive Sports Center. So tell me a little bit about Rocky Mountain.
Well, Rocky Mountain, we've been around in our sixth year of operations. We originated from an adaptive ski program at Sunshine Village Ski School, and since then we've expanded. We formed a nonprofit, and we're now a charity. And we offer our mission is to enable all children and adults with physical, developmental, cognitive, or other challenges to participate, to learn, and excel in all sports and recreation activities that we have available to us here in the Rocky Mountains.
So, what sorts of sports programs do you offer?
Well, we offer a wide variety of programs. We have alpine skiing, snowboarding, Nordic skiing, snowshoeing. In the winter, and of course, in the summer, we do tennis and golf, frisbee golf, swimming, biking, hiking, paddling, all sorts of paddling, kayaks, canoes, stand-up paddleboarding, rafting, horseback riding. We've introduced dance, karate, and yoga recently.
So, is there any modified equipment involved in these sports?
Yes, for sure. Particularly for people with physical challenges, we have sit skis, we have outriggers, we have hand cycles as opposed to your typical cycle that you would see. So, also on our paddling equipment, we have outriggers to stabilize the equipment.
So, in your time with Rocky Mountain, have you seen any challenges with the organization?
Well, of course, like many nonprofits and charities, we depend heavily on donations to keep us going. We're in Alberta, and as everyone knows right now, it's tough economic times in Alberta. So that's one of our biggest challenges. But getting volunteers is not a challenge, and also the demand is exceeding our capacity at the moment.
So to look at the converse side of things, has there been any one success moment that stood out for you?
I think every individual is a success. When you see someone who, because of their physical or developmental challenge, starts to begin a mountain sport or recreation activity and sees they can do it, I think that brings not only a smile to their face, but a smile to all the volunteers and the people that are involved with Rocky Mountain. So there's not one, there's many. There's many success stories. Everyone is a success story.
So, how does the community typically respond to the work?
We're in the Bow Valley here, which goes everywhere from Lake Louise, Banff, Canmore, and Kananaskis. Our community has been very supportive of us. We have some great sponsors here in the valley. We're setting up an organization here to enhance belonging through sport in the community.
So, how are you spreading the word about this work?
Well, word of mouth is a big thing. Once people hear about us and see what we're doing, that's always a big way. But we also, through social media, through our website, through Facebook, through Twitter, we're getting the word out about what we do.
Now,
and we have people come from the UK, Australia, United States, so somehow the word is getting out there that this is the place to come.
Now, earlier when you mentioned improving belonging. Can you tell me a little more about what that means?
Well, this is a group called True Sport, which I think is a national organization, and we have a chapter here in the Bow Valley. Just that there's a belief that through belonging in sport, through doing team sports, et cetera, or not just team sports, but sports, it creates a better sense of belonging in your community.
So, you mentioned the volunteers earlier. Can you tell me about some of the people that make Rocky Mountain work?
We have a wide variety of volunteers, from fairly young students that recently, some of them are high school students, some are recent university graduates, all the way to some, I'll call it senior, because I'm one of those people, volunteers, you know, professionals that give their time on the weekend. I mean, they get as much out of it. Many of them have told me that they think they probably get more out of it sometimes than the participants in our program.
So if you could send any one message to the community about the need for inclusion in sport, what would you say?
No matter what difficulties or obstacles lie in the way for any individual with, as I said earlier, physical development or cognitive challenges, there's no limit. If those people have the desire to learn, we have the desire to help them learn how to do those sports and recreation activities.
Do you work in partnership with any other groups?
We have some partners that we work with, the town of Canmore, for example, trail sports at Canmore Nordic Center, and our biggest partner is Sunshine Village. They've been extremely generous to us and go out of their way to help the adaptive program up at Sunshine Village.
So what are the next steps for Rocky Mountain?
Well, like many charities, we have to start looking at some social enterprises. We like to see ourselves as become a center of excellence for adaptive sports, training the trainers, for example, taking our model and spreading that model across Canada, perhaps creating some sort of a national or international conference here in Banff, Canmore, about adaptive sports and recreation, getting some keynote speakers in, attracting vendors that, for example, provide hand cycles or sit skis, things like that.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
All right, well, thank you.
Of course. I find it just remarkable some of the adaptations that can be made for people with disabilities in terms of athletics and sport. We might think on the surface something like wheelchair tennis might be impractical because of the rate at which your average wheelchair would turn, and people might tend to look at it from that angle. But there are those who ask the questions, how can this be made more maneuverable? How can we make it more agile to get it into an actual sport? Now, Steve and Rocky Mountain have done quite a bit of innovation in this way, in my opinion. What Steve was describing in terms of just making things possible for people with disabilities struck me as just remarkable. But the fact is, it's not about giving them an unfair advantage in their training and in their sport. It is about leveling the playing field. It's about getting people out there of comparable abilities just to do what they love to do, what comes naturally to them. It is about great athletics and great enjoyment from these games. Now, the public does tend to take note of things such as the Special Olympics, the Paralympics, but I put it to you, there can be more representation, because just knowing about the large-scale stuff that everybody knows about is not enough. Athletic programs such as Rocky Mountain exist and they operate on a day-to-day basis, providing opportunities. Show me a sports page that provides any sort of coverage to this. The fact is, you could make a case for any group in society, really, that they're entitled to equal representation. Fact is, when it comes to news and sports coverage, we're fed a very steady diet of the same thing, essentially. But if you want to look at athletes from third world countries or female athletes or athletes with disabilities, you have to think outside the box. And we as a society owe it to these athletes who train just as hard, push themselves every day to reach their best, to acknowledge this is just as much a sport, just as much a great event as you would see any able-bodied athlete engage in. I had the chance some time ago to interview a representative of the Paralympic Committee, talked about how athletes with disabilities aren't given the same endorsements as their able-bodied counterparts. My opinion? It's utterly ridiculous. If an athlete gets out there and plays a great game, and they push themselves, they train themselves, and they ultimately achieve great things, what does it matter if the equipment's a little different, or their personal background is a little different, or their gender's different? Fact is, none of that should come out when they're out there on the field doing their thing. It should simply be taken as great athletics, great sport, great enjoyment. But we as a society don't always see it from this viewing angle. In my opinion, we should, but it's not to say that the coverage should be entirely geared towards one group in society. People with disabilities, women, people of different cultural background. No. What I would call for is a little more balance. You can represent these groups in society. You can acknowledge their strength and their endurance. That's what organizations that provide disabilities athletic training are really doing. They're saying, we recognize that you have a gift to contribute. We're going to give you the modified equipment, the training, and the tools to use it. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Ontario Students Against Impaired Driving is an anti-impaired driving initiative that strives to promote smart, healthy choices through education and public awareness to prevent tragedies caused by impaired and distracted driving. OSAID is about teens helping teens to consider safe alternatives and new perspectives to the perceived norms about alcohol, illicit drugs, and dangerous driving. For more information or to join the team, visit www.osaid.org.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Steve Horner, who was telling us about some disability sports and recreation programs through Rocky Mountain. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Paul and Allison Fraze from the Joshua Fraze Foundation. So tell me a little bit about the latest happenings with the foundation.
Paul, do you want to start?
Oh, sure. Certainly the latest happenings with the foundation. We've been intricately involved with research for many, many years, two decades, and the research has culminated in very, very robust preclinical trial data to the point that we were able to attract venture capital, and a company has been formed, and we like to say we're racing towards clinical trials. As we all know, science can sometimes seem like it goes so slow, but we are coming up on preparing for clinical trials at this point. The foundation has been involved with this process every step of the way. So why don't you go ahead.
So for those who might have missed our prior interview, can you tell me about the foundation itself? What sprung it to life?
Sure. Our son, Joshua, was born in 1995. And at that time, when he was diagnosed at 3.5 months of age with a muscle biopsy, we were told that there was only 55 children worldwide with this ultra-rare orphan disease called myotubular myopathy. Before he was a year old, we started the foundation, the Joshua Frey Foundation, because we felt it was our place to do something to make a difference. There was no research being constructed at that time here in the U.S. There was a little bit going on in Europe. We formed our foundation in 96. In 97, we put together our first team at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And it was a slow process, I would say, the first 13 years, understanding the pathology of the disorder, the mechanism in which how it functioned, getting patients and other families involved in research initiatives to learn more about the disorder, being, you know, a patient advocate to the community. It was just, it was a slow growing community at that time. Now we have, you know, families all over the world, and I have 5 continents. I'm always constantly speaking and encouraging and educating, you know, families to clinicians, actually, and the foundation has become a one of the stakeholders in the congenital myopathy space, very well respected. You know, our website, joshuafreys.org, is a resource for families and clinicians for the most current research pertaining to myotubular myopathy, resources on how to care for these children, how to keep them alive until we reach a therapy. So that's kind of a Reader's Digest version of 20 years of work.
So in the time with the foundation, what's been the greatest success that you've experienced?
I would say our lives are much richer and fuller because our son lived and because of the families that we have met on this journey. I will say that it is a very difficult situation for any parent to be faced with such a death sentence. But I will say that the joy truly outweighs the pain that the families and the relationships that we have developed through the years have just made our lives richer and fuller. I say that so often, and still to this day, I truly believe that.
I think what we tend to miss sometimes, and more the general public that's not affected with an orphan disease like such as this, we fail to realize how important these lives are and how incredibly beautiful the things that we learn from these children and people that have, you know, that are afflicted with these orphan diseases. As far as a success, the word success, I mean, there are very, very few indications in disease states that get to clinical trials. So I think the fact that we were involved with putting together some of the best scientists globally, and they had altruistic beliefs of getting this science to the bedside, and we are closing in on that. We're not there yet. There's still some hurdles to jump, and still a lot of things that have to take place, but we are, you know, in the throes and moving towards clinical trials. So the ultimate success will be if these clinical trials prove successful to the point of saving lives and enhancing lives and giving these children, seeing a child that maybe once was bound to a wheelchair be able to stand, or a child that was bound to a ventilator be able to take that, you know, be able to extubate and take that ventilator off that child, and that child being able to breathe on their own. So the greatest successes obviously are to come, and we always push forward knowing that.
So how has the public responded to the word that clinical trials are on the horizon?
A lot of excitement, a lot of anticipation. There's still hurdles that we need to overcome. But it has been a lot of work, you know, just keeping these families, speaking hope into their lives and encouraging them on this journey, because they're very anxious to move this process along. Of course, on the pharma side, they still have some hurdles that they need to get through in order for us to, start clinical. So we're close. We're almost there. Their speculation is 2017, and that we're hoping that as well, that is executed by early 2017.
So when you speak of giving hope to all these families out there, if you could send any message to them, what would you say?
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I mean, I think first and foremost, live each day right now to its fullest. Don't live your life thinking the cure will happen tomorrow. We want to squeeze every ounce of life out of enjoying our children and out of trying to do normal things or take our children to the zoo, take your children out, give them normal experiences. That's really a message of that we try to portray, live your life, enjoy life, do whatever you can to bring normalcy to your life. On the flip side, we also, with guarded hope and with caution, we always say there are good things happening in science, and we are excited about the possibility of a cure. So keep that dream alive as well.
I would like to add to that. I believe that, just from experience and seeing these families that walk this on a day-to-day journey, when you have a child that is born with special needs, a life-threatening disorder, you learn to live within that moment, within that day. We get anxious when we think about tomorrow, but, I can't think about tomorrow. You have to just enjoy the moment and enjoy the day that you're in. For me, it was a big shift. I'm a planner. I'm an executor. I want to, what was I going to do in a month and a year and 2 years? All of that completely changes when you have a child that is born with special needs. You really, truly, your dreams of the future, those are completely gone. You have to shift that focus to enjoy today. What is the joy of the moment and joy of today? And so for me, it's just really trying to keep moms and dads in that moment, enjoying the time that you have with your child. We never know. We're all here on borrowed time. We never know what tomorrow is going to hold, but especially when you have a child with a rare disorder, you really live in the moment.
I'd thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Of course. Live each day. A message everyone with a disability can take to heart. Fact is, if you live each day with enough enjoyment, enough heart, whatever the condition is, it seems less and less, at least for that moment in time. But it is true, you should live with guarded hope, for if you live in hope enough days, one day it will be justified. There's nothing quite so amazing, in my opinion, in disability life, seeing parents working just to give their child a better chance in life. If a condition affects one person and it's declared hopeless, that's one too many. There's always hope. It's just up to us as a society to keep pressing forward, keep taking the steps that can improve quality of life, ultimately with the goal of a cure in mind. But the steps to get there, clinical trials, relieving pain, allowing someone to breathe on their own, perhaps for the very first time, something so many of us just take for granted. But I've come to realize there's no such thing as a normal person out there. We all have things that just make us unique. They can be seen as a limitation or a curse, or we can look at them It's a unique perspective, a way of seeing each day a little differently. And we can choose to embrace the blessings that come along with that. It's all in how you choose to look at it, folks. It's all the question of, am I going to make this an insurmountable, destructive force in my life? Or am I going to choose to look at it as one factor that can and will be subject to change? These parents have done pretty much the impossible in founding the foundation. They've worked for years just to reach out to others and say, you're not facing this alone. That's the biggest thing you can do with any orphan condition, is find those affected. Learn from them. Share your own insights. Just don't live under that illusion that says, I have to face this alone. I have to be strong enough on my own. It's not true for anybody, whether they have a disability or not. Nobody gets through life without support, without a little help from time to time. Things like the Joshua Fraze Foundation are really providing a voice that says, if nothing else, we're going to tell you this doesn't have to be the end. There are survivors. There are people who are working to make this better. And you have to live with little faith. But don't let it stop you from living the moment, enjoying the things you love. Yeah, disability life is all about finding modifications or thinking in a new way. But once you've gotten through the technical aspects, it's really a matter of being out there, living, loving, enjoying. What every parent wants for their child is just the best, the fullest, richest quality of life available. And sometimes, for a parent of a child with a disability, it's a matter of doing research. It's a matter of taking those long nights to ask, is there anything that can be done? Poking and prodding away what seems like a massive problem. Once you realize there are steps that can be taken, there are people you can talk to, even if it's nothing more than moral support you find, you do find something. Parents who work tirelessly for their children who have disabilities and special needs, I have all the respect in the world for them, in so much as they're doing it for the best reason possible, love. They're doing it because they brought a wonderful, potential little life into the world. And no life, regardless of the condition, is bereft of potential, hopes, dreams. As long as there's life, there's hope, folks. And for Paul and Allison Fraze, the work to create hope didn't end at their own doorstep. They didn't just say, we're going to take steps that are good for us. They reached out. They chose to create something so much better and brighter. And it really does have the potential to open doors in the near future. As we look at it today, this is an orphan condition. This is something that maybe society doesn't know a lot about. But if we look at it 10 years from now, from the angle of these clinical trials, seeing what can be done, then maybe the work they're doing today will save lives and better lives tomorrow. Live with that hope day by day, and I promise it will be justified. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.